is look a little bit at Parshas Hazinu and then try to fill in some loose ends from the Yom Kippur topics that we've either started or that you've had a chance to look at a little bit in terms of Samar Makomos. And we'll talk, I guess, try to talk about all those briefly. In terms of Hazinu, so as we mentioned last week, we have discretion to expand our parameters a little bit because we didn't do Hazinu at all last year. So we could expand it to the first two Aliyahs, which would give us as many as 12 Psukim to talk about. But the truth is, we'll probably...
There's lots of explanation anyway. So.
Right, there's a lot of explanation. So, but the truth is, I don't even know how much we'll get to the second Aliyah. We'll focus more on the first Aliyah and the Parsha as a whole. The Parsha as a whole itself is a unusual Parsha, but maybe in some sense a stand-in for the entire Torah. Because at the end of last week's Parsha, we have a reference, really two references, to Hashira Hazos. And that seems to be a reference to this specific Parsha, to Parsha Sa'azinu, which is also, therefore, at the core of the mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah, of the last mitzvah in the Torah, the 613th mitzvah of Yata Kisvu Lachem Es HaShira Hazos. So how that exactly comes to refer to the whole Torah is a big discussion, because the Rambam understands it to mean that really it's a reference to this week's Parsha, it's a reference to Hazinu, but you can't write a Parsha by itself, and therefore it turns out we have to write down the whole Torah. It's really a hell of an idea. And this discussion in the Shagas Aryeh about that, so what does that mean? Does that mean that really we need to have Hazinu, but we can't write a Parsha by itself, so we have to write out a whole Sefer Torah? Or does it mean that really we want to have a whole Sefer Torah, and Hazinu is our way of getting there? A nafkamina for if you have a Sefer Torah that was written, but then it's faded away, a lot of it, but you still have Hazinu, will that accomplish what we're looking for? So the whole usage of the term Shira to refer to Hazinu is itself a little bit difficult to understand because it's not a very cheerful topic, cheerful or cheerful, however you want to say it. It's not a very pleasant parsha in terms of, it's poetic, so I guess it sounds like a Shira in that sense, but it's very scary. It has a lot of tochacha. The Ramban in his commentary understands the previous parsha, that the reference to Shira is to the fact that this parsha Hazinu that's coming up in the reference last week is sung all the time. So what does that mean that it's sung all the time? It sounds like it's a reference to the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that we'll talk about a little bit more, that this parsha was sung as part of the Musfei Shabbos in the Beis HaMikdash. But that doesn't really explain all the time. The Rambam in Hilchos Tefillah in Parak Zayin Halacha Gimel, it makes reference to the fact that there are places where they would say Hazinu every day. Maybe for that reason it's called Shira. There are others who understand Shira in this context as meaning something different. But Victor Katz is one of the Rishonim, so they have a section of his comments on the Torah that was printed in the Sefer Zikaron for Bezalel Werner that came out a few years ago and is quoted in the Paris Yosef HaChadash, and he understands that Shira is actually Miloshen Tsar. It's a reference to the negativity of the Parsha. The Sefer Mincha Lula, who's also quoted there, as well as under others, make reference to the Pasuk in Parsha's Bala, in the Nevuah of Bilam, where he talks about Ashurenu as a reference to seeing the future, and that therefore the prophecies that are a part of this parsha are the reason for the name Shira. The Haksava HaKabbalah comments that the language of Shira is from the same root as Shira in the sense of a song, and it has to do with Yashar, it has to do with being straight, which is a theme in the Torah as a whole, a theme in Sefer Dvarim as a whole, which according to the Gemara in Avodah Zarah is referred to as Sefer HaYashar because of its exhortations towards Yashrus, included perhaps in this parsha as well, and that's what we mean when we talk about Shira, that the whole Torah as referred to in Parshas Vayelech as a Shira means the whole Sefer is a Sefer of Yashrus, So we will call it Shira for that purpose. The negativity in terms of the Nevuahs, so the Paris Yosef HaChadash quotes an idea as well, that from one of the Belzer Rebbe's, that we know we have an idea that, like the Gemara said, Mishnah says in Menachos, that Osek B'Torah Sa'ola Ki'ilu Hikriv Ola, if a person studies the topic of the Karbanos, it's as if he brought the Karbanos. So too, it's a different application. But the negativity of this parsha is really positive, because if we read these tochachas, it will accomplish for us as if we went through them, and therefore it'll save us from having to go through them. So therefore, it really is a happy result. It really is cheerful and cheerful. Okay, well, we'll come back to that point perhaps in a few minutes. But it's also interesting in terms of commenting on the parsha as a whole, that the Gemara Maseches Rosh Hashanah on Daf Lamed Aleph Lamed Aleph tells us that there is an acronym, Haziv Lach, which tells us how to divide up the psukim in Parshas Hazinu, how to identify where the aliyos break. And it's on the one hand, it's helpful. On the other hand, it's not as helpful as it could be. The Gemara over there says that that was how they broke it up in the Beis HaMikdash, and that's how we should do it in Bate Knesios as well. That's how we should do it in Shul also. So that would be great. It's a great acronym. The problem is that there's a big machlokus in Rishonim as to how this acronym, Haziv Lach, how it indicates how you divide up the psukim, because there are other candidates for the various letters. Yud could stand for a couple of psukim, for example. So there probably are as many as six different views in Rishonim. The Paris Yosef, he goes through all of them. If you want to look for the ones that are more accessible, so if you look at the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, so you'll see Rashi says one way and Rabbeinu Hananel says another way. And the way we have it in our Chumashim is the third way. It's the way that the Rambam brings it. The Rambam is in Hilchos Tefillah and Perek Gimel Halacha Hey. He's based on the Rif. And the Shulchan Aruch Pasuk is like that. That's the way we have it in our Chumashim. But it's quite fascinating that here we have one parsha in the Torah where the Gemara gives us a system to figure out how to divide it up, and we're not sure what that means. And it's important because here we have this din. And Rav Soloveitchik understood the way Rav Shechter relates it. Rav Shechter talks about this in Sefer Nefesh HaRav, that this is a din of reading it kichsava. The Gemara is telling us how it's written, and since when we come to Kriyas HaTorah, we have to read it the way it's written, so that becomes a crucial din in the Kriyas HaTorah of Parshas Hazinu. And based on that, he essentially disagrees with the psak of the Shulchan Aruch, like the Mordechai, and the Ramah, according to Mordechai. The Ramah quotes the Mordechai that we don't have to worry about this during the week. But on Shabbos, okay, so we'll stick to the standard. But during the week, when we only read three aliyahs anyway, so we don't have to have such a kveda. But Shiari Knesses HaGedola disagreed. He applied it to the week as well. And that's how Rav Shechter explains in the Nefesh HaRav that the Rav Soloveitchik understood it's midin reading it kichsava, and therefore that's necessary as well. That you have to read the Sefer Torah the way it was written, and apparently this formulation, this division, is built into its structure, so that becomes a necessary way to lane it. So it's not just that we have to lane it like that on Shabbos, but anytime we lane it, we have to maintain the structure.
There was a minyan today. There was a little bit of I guess hullabaloo. The Balkorer read later, and then everyone thought that he made a mistake, and then Rutorsky quieted everyone down. And was that okay? Add to this.
He read past me.
He read past where the sitter said Rishon. Is that because he was holding like this old Rav Soloveitchik?
It could be. It could be. I mean, it does apply to the weekday.
Oh, it does apply.
It does apply to the weekday. Not, yeah. So that's,
but it wouldn't be okay in theory.
Right. So maybe that was about.
I don't know
exactly what's going on, but it could be that that's a machlokas whether that applies to weekdays. So maybe that was behind the hullabaloo. So there are those who comment as well that the acronym sounds like it means something. Haziv Lach, it's a nice phrase, you know, Ziv is glory, is beauty. So the glory is to you, so to speak. So Rabbeinu Bachaya understood that it's a way of saying that we are looking for a restoration of glory. That's what the Psukim are telling us. And Maharsha, over there in Rosh Hashanah, the Maharsha comments that this is a reference to the ziv of Moshe's face, when Moshe's face shone. So this is a way of saying we want that back. Rav Nosson Gestetner has a very long pilpul where he connects that to the idea that the Gemara says that when the Klal Yisrael accepted the Torah and said Nasa V'Nishma, so the, all these crowns came down from Shemayim and were given to the Jewish people, and then when the Jews sinned, so Moshe Rabbeinu collected them all up. So his ziv, so to speak, his glory is the glory that we want back through tshuva, that we need to return to us. So maybe that's why there's a reference. He says it in a much longer, more involved way, but that's the gist of it. That maybe that's what we're saying when we talk about this parasha of the Tochacha, and we say we want the ziv back. We want the ziv that Moshe Rabbeinu, so to speak, was holding on our behalf because we lost this chus. Rav Moshe Wolfson, a mashgiach from Tarei V'Das, is a sefer Munas Itecha. So he connects, you know, ziv again means hadar. So the Gemara says about an esrog that the Torah calls it pre-eitz hadar, and the Gemara understands in one place that hadar hadar be'ilan meshana l'shana, that it stands hadar, that it resides on the tree from year to year. And Rav Wolfson suggests that all these ideas come together, that the glory of the Jewish people, the ziv, is that we are able to survive all the ups and downs. So all the seasons, the winter and the summer, everything comes and goes, and the esrog survives, so too the Jew survives through it all, through the ups and the downs, the goods and the bads, and that's what this parsha of Tochacha is therefore clued in with this word haziv. The Rambam also writes over there in Hilchos Tshuva, in Hilchos Tefillah, excuse me, but about the point about Tshuva, that normally we have a hakbada when we lane, that we have to end an aliyah on a davar tov, on a positive note. So he says that when it comes to Parshas Hazino, we don't have such a kbeda, and this system of breaking up the aliyahs, so it ends sometimes on a negative note. But he says it's okay because it's not a stam negative note, but it's a negative note of tochacha. It's there for our own good, so therefore it's okay to stop at those points, to stop on those points of negativity. And Gestetner again discusses the fact that you have to figure out what the connection is. So because it's Tochacha, therefore we should stop on those points, because we wouldn't get the Musar if we didn't pause then to think about it. So presumably, like he explains, it really means the reverse, that since we are now focused on a concept of Tshuva Me'ava, of happily embracing our opportunities for growth, so the fact that we're getting Tochacha now, that's something that becomes a positive note, and therefore it's okay to end the Aliyah there. Not that we have to end the Aliyah there in order for the Tochacha to work, but it's considered to be a Davar Tov because it's a source of inspiration and growth in that sense of Tochacha. Okay, so those are the thumb words about the parsha as a whole. So maybe let's try to look at least at the first aliyah. So the parsha begins, Hazinu Hashamayim V'Adabera, that there is this declaration that the Shamayim should give ear, should lend my ear, lend its ear, and the land, V'Tishma Ha'aretz Imrefi, the land should listen. And the Sefrei points out that in the beginning of Sefer Yeshaya, so you have the opposite. It says, Shimu Shamayim V'Hazinu Yaretz. And Yeshaya tells the sky to do Shmia and the land to do Ha'azana. And the Medrash goes on to explain that Moshe Rabbeinu was closer to Shamayim and Yeshaya was closer to the ground. And the Torah Tamima fills in the details a little bit about what's going on. It says the language of Ha'azana, the Hazana and Shmiah, they both seem to mean listening. But Hazana, you give the ear, so that's the kind of thing you would say to somebody who's listening nearby. The Space Medrash gives a good way to illustrate that point. So you have a lot of people talking in the Base Medrash at once, so you're listening to the person who's closest to you, so you'll tilt your ear to listen to that person. But you hear the things that are going on in the room as a whole without filtering your ear. So Hazana is the word you use for that which is closer to you, and Shmiah is that which is further. So that's what the Medrash suggests, that Moshe and Yeshayahu were inverted as far as that's concerned. But the reference, as Rashi explains, is that Moshe is saying that the sky and the earth that are always going to be here, So they should be Edim, that they should testify to the bris in case there's any desire to deny that the bris is there. So even after Moshe Rabbeinu is no longer alive, he has now one parsha left. But even after that, the sky and the land will continue to give testimony. And the Orach Chaim says differently. The Orach Chaim says that the Shemayim is a reference to the Gedolim, to the leaders of the generation. And they have to listen to, and that's how it gets transmitted to the Hamon. That's the Aretz. That's what makes the message effectively transfer to those down below, so to speak. So the next pasuk, fascinating interpretations. The next pasuk says, "Yarof kamatar lekhi tizal katalim rasi." So my lekach, meaning my Torah, will come down like rain. Sounds like a beautiful idea. But the Gemara Maseches Tainis has a somewhat scarier association with this pasuk, and it says that this teaches us that somebody who's involved in Torah shelo lishma, so nice and low kesam hamaves, that it's going to work out badly for him. And Yarof in this context is kelashon arifa, like egla arufa. It's gonna kill you, so to speak. So that's a difficult idea in general, the whole notion of Torah Shelo Lashma being bad. That's an issue we find in general, somewhat of a tension between different Gemaras. So that Gemara criticizes Torah Shelo Lashma, says it's nice to los amat maves. The Gemara in the end of the second parak of Brachas and Daf Yud Zayin also is very critical about Torah Shelo Lashma. It calls it a Noach Lo Shelo Nivra, a person who's involved in Torah Shelo Lashma. And yet we know, both from other places in Chazal and practice, that we promote Torah Shelo Lashma. The Gemara says in Psachim that in Daf Nun that Va'olam Yasek Adam B'Torah Mitzvahs Afilu Shelo Lashma Shemitoch Shelo Lashma Balashma. We encourage learning that's not lishma, because that will bring about learning that is lishma. So which is it? So are we pro shelo lishma, or are we not pro shelo lishma? So Tosfos over there in Brachos and in Tainis gives an important chiluk. The Tosfos says that there's different kinds of shelo lishma. It's a question what lishma means, so you have to figure that out also. But there's different kinds of shelo lishma. You know, there are those who have suggested that somebody who learns to get a better shidduch is lishma, literally, right, for her sake. But it's definitely a different interpretation of lishma. So shelo lishma, one example Tosfos gives is a person wants kavod, a person wants to be known as a rabbi, as a Talmud Chacham. So that's shelo lishma. But that's the shelo lishma that we can handle, right? That's the shelo lishma. That's the adult version of you give a child a reward for learning. So shelo lishma we can handle. That's a shelo lishma that will lead to lishma. But shelo lishma that we can't handle, that's worse than nothing. So that's what Tosfos calls lakanter, which means presumably somebody really wants to attack others. So he learns in order to have what to attack with. Which we'll assume doesn't mean, you know, the Gemara also praises Mulchamta Shel Torah, so somebody who likes getting into it with his chavrus. I don't think that's the kind of Shel Lishma we're talking about, but somebody who's really looking to cause tzaras for people by having a few marmakomas up his sleeve, and his whole learning is there so that he could be a dangerous force in the world with his attacks. So then that's what we say, Noach Lo Shelo Nivra. Rav Sternbuch, in his writings, he suggests that the issue is, you know, what are we talking about when we say Shelo Lishma? Are we talking about that you have good and bad motives mixed in? So in that case, we'll say, okay, we'll tolerate the bad motives because the good motives will ultimately come to dominate. Or are we saying that you do it exclusively for bad motives? The Shuvas Das Kohen of the Spinker Rav, so he, using a model that you find by Kavana and Mitzvahs in general, he says that if you have no Kavana, no specific Kavana Lishma, so then okay, so then we can handle that. But the negative kavana, which I guess Lakanter is in the category of negative kavana, so that comes and undoes your neutral kavana, so to speak, and that defines your kavana negatively, and that's where things get really bad. Again, what exactly is the definition of lishma is a big question. Chaim Volozhiner had a big treatise about it, which Balaam wrote about in English, the Torah Lishma, where he understood Lishma meaning to know the Torah itself is considered to be a Torah Lishma. And there is the Chashuva comment that the Eglei Tal has in his Hakdama. I don't know if we ever got to quote the Hakdama last year, we talked about the Eglei Tal so often. But the Eglei Tal in his Hakdama says, and I once had somebody ask me this question, Lamaisa, very fine Jew asked me this question exactly the way Eglei Tal describes it. Says that some people think that if they enjoy the learning too much, so that's not lishma, because they're doing it because they enjoy it. And the Eglei Tal responded, Chas v'shalom to have such a question. That is lishma, that if a person gets hana from the fact that he sees how everything comes together and he sees the emes that comes from learning, so we wouldn't call that lishma. We would call that the ikar of lishma, the person who's connecting so much to the truth of the Torah that it's mahanahim, that it creates pleasure. So then he would say that's the definition of lishma. And we would say the other way, that if a person is miserable, maybe it's not the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, maybe he's really missing something. But to say it's not lishma because you're enjoying it, that's that we wouldn't say, chas v'shalom. So there is a interesting comment of the Netziv, which I was wondering if it's not exactly the same, but it's somewhat l'shitaso in a comment he has over here in the parsha. So the Netziv in a tshuva, so he emphasizes that lishma is particularly a concern when we're talking about somebody who's looking to make chidushim or to paskin. So then it's crucial that his intent be 100% pure. And a chiddush that's created out of a desire that's shelo lishma, so that's something that's very dangerous.
Where's this from?
It's from the Netziv. It's a little bit evocative of a comment that the Chassam Sofer has as well. The Chassam Sofer is famous for emphasizing the fact that it's a shayla. Nowadays, how we write down Torah Shabbat Peh, we're not supposed to write down the Torah Shabbat Peh. So the Gemara says that Torah was going to get lost. So Rabbi Yudanossi wrote down the Mishnayos, and we wrote down the Gemaras. Ravina and Ravashi edited the Gemaras. We were worried that the Torah Shabbat Peh was going to get forgotten. So the Chassam Sofer has a whole discussion about if somebody's going to publish Svarim and write down the Torah Shabbat Peh, it's 100% crucial that he has absolutely lishma intent, because otherwise it's also to write it down. So the only heter to write it down is because the Gemara says "Islasos Lashem ki yifar terusecha," and if that's not your kavana, so that's very dangerous. It happens to be that his Rebbe, the Chassam Sofer, was Reb Nosson Adler. So Reb Nosson Adler, we don't have svarim from him, because his shita, the way it was reported, is that he felt he was only allowed to write down if he was going to forget, and he was confident that he wasn't going to forget his chidushim. He just put a dot in his Gemara whenever he had a chiddush, and he didn't write it down. It doesn't really help us now that we don't have his chidushim to read, although Chassam Sofer, his Talmud, quotes him pretty often in his tshuvas. But in any event, so Chassam Sofer emphasized this importance of lishma for writing. But the Netziv, a little bit different, the Netziv emphasizes that if somebody is going to be involved in the chidushei Torah, or in Hora, and is not the Lishma, so then that's very dangerous. So it happens to be, it's interesting, so he says that in the Tshuva, and it's not exactly the same thing, but it's parallel to a comment he has over here in the Parsha. So remember the Gemara in Tainus Darshan, this Pasuk, Yarov Kumatar Lichi, as a reference to the dangers of Torah Shelo Lishma. So the Netziv commenting on this Pasuk, so he talks about the next part, about Tizal Katalim Rasi. And he says this idea of tal, we know, is the lighter rain, is the lighter dew. The Gemara says hakol smeichen bo, as the Torah Tumim explains, kol smeichen bo, because it doesn't get anybody's way. Rain is good and bad. Right? So sometimes we need rain in order for the world to survive. But if it's going to rain out our baseball game, or if it's going to, or if it's going to be a storm that's going to be dangerous, it's going to be bad. So rain could be good or bad. But Tal is never bad. It never gets in anybody's way. So it's always nice. So the Netziv says the drushes are the nice drushes that are given. That's like Tal. But the Tal has to come after Yarov Kamatar Likhi. The Likhi is a reference to the Kilak Echtov Nasati Lachem Tarosi Alta Azovu, is the serious Limud HaTorah. And the Netziv emphasizes that the ones who are going to say the drushes are going to have to be those who first invested the serious time in actual serious learning. Otherwise, the drushes are not going to reflect truth. And presumably what he's getting at is, we know, we say Meshivan ala drush, we don't challenge drush, because drush, essentially the potential sometimes exists to say anything. So it's especially crucial that the ones who are directing how the drush is going to go should be the ones who are rooted very firmly in serious learning. And then in the Herchev Dover, on the bottom of the page of the Hemek Dover, so that it goes on to talk about writing Chidushim and Tanakh, and that it's crucial that those who write Chidushim and Tanakh are also heavily rooted in Shas and learning of that nature. So it's not exactly what he says in the Tshuva, but it's all parallel, that if someone's going to say Chidushim and Torah, or Paskin and Torah, or say Drashos, or say Chidushim and Tanakh, so it requires first a serious commitment to Talmud Torah, and Talmud Torah that is motivated Lashma, as he emphasizes in this Tshuva.
So being said, many, like, it's very like common when people are like, you know, the Pasuk says X, Y, and Z, and I feel it's really saying this. If they're not quoting Rashi or Rishon or anything like that, it's really problematic.
You know, it's just dangerous. You know, I think this is the point, is that a person should have a sensitivity when he's deviating from the traditional interpretation. So sometimes a Talmud Chacham will deviate from the traditional interpretation, and if he's rooted in the Mesorah itself, so that he has more leeway to do that. But if somebody's not coming from such a strong foundation, so if he's going to say something that's not such a radical shift, so then it's not going to be felt as much. But somebody who's going to say something really mechudesh, if he's not, it's an itziv to put the two places together, lishma and grounded in a very serious foundation, so then it's risky. Then it's something that's, you could come up with something that's not accurate. Especially in the area of Jewish, perhaps that's what he's getting at. The Klausenberger Rebbe has a tshuva when he talks about in general the idea of kavana and mitzvos in general. So sometimes it's a whole question without getting into the sugya now, because it's a long sugya that will prevent us from talking about anything else. But it's not clear how we paskin on the issue of mitzvos riches kavana. The Gemara has this open question that, whether or not we need kavanah and we do mitzvos, and it's possible that there's a chiluk. You know, the Gemara says that a person who is misasek, a person who's not even paying any attention, but he does an avera of arayos, or of eating something aser, or chaylev, so then he's chayiv anyway, shekein nana, since he got physical benefit from it, so the lack of intent doesn't save him. So we may have a similar chiluk when it comes to mitzvos. That's how some suggest. So for example, the shofar, Gemara talks about the example of shofar and matzah, and the Rambam seems to split the psak, that the shofar, he requires kavana, and matzah he doesn't. So some explain that matzah is eating, it's a physical hana, so you can be yotzei the mitzvah even without such intent. While shofar is more ephemeral, to listen to the shofar is a more ephemeral experience. If you don't have intent, maybe you can't be yotzei the mitzvah that way. So the Klausenberger Rebbe discusses the question of Talmud Torah. What type of kavana do we need, and how should we view it? And he quotes from the Balatania that there's really two mitzvahs of Talmud Torah, at least. But at least two you could make note of. There is the mitzvah of learning, which is more experiential, let's say. And there is the mitzias of yediyas haTorah, that one is obligated to acquire as much Torah knowledge as he can. So the Torah knowledge acquisition, that's like eating, so to speak. That's mitzias. A person has it. If he learns, then he gets it, so then he has it. While the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, and the experiencing Talmud Torah, that requires more kavana in that sense. That's how he suggested. And that's similar to a chiluk other achronim have, that we talk about. It's also consistent with the nitziv. But if we're talking about Talmud Torah in terms of acquiring knowledge, so then it's easier to say that whatever your motivations are, but you're acquiring knowledge, so then it's worthwhile. If you're going to learn the Torah for whatever motivation, so fine. Then mitoch shel lishma balishma. But if you're going to try to go beyond acquiring knowledge, you're going to try to be mechadesh, you're going to try to pasken, you're going to try to take it to the next level, so then that requires more pure lishma intent. So it's consistent with the schilik that Klausenberger mentions based on the Balatanya, that there's two different mitzvos, and maybe the mitzvah of Yediyas HaTorah, we're less concerned about the kavana. But beyond the Yediyas HaTorah, there is a greater need that we have these elements in order. To continue a little bit before we should say a few words about Yom Kippur. At the end of the pasuk, it talks about Kisirim Alei Dasha, Chavivim Alei Esev, which literally means different types of rain on the ground. But the Medrash also has a drasha that the Seirim are Mechaprim, so too Divrei Torah are Mechaprim. So we should just mention that because it's in line with what we've been talking about the past few weeks, of the role of Talmud Torah and Shuvah. This next pasuk is a very major pasuk. It's actually going to take us a good few minutes also to talk about. This next pasuk we're all familiar with, even if we didn't read the Chumash, but if we daven Mincha, we daven Musaf, so we know this next pasuk because we have adopted it as the introduction to Shemona Esrei, when there's no din of Smichas Gula Tfila. So when it comes to Shacharis and Ma'ariv, we want to have a direct connection between the bracha of Gal Yisrael and Shmona Esrei, so we don't interrupt with much Shacharis with nothing, with Ma'ariv a little bit more. It's a whole separate discussion for a different time. So we don't put this pasuk in, but for Mincha and for Musaf, so we introduce our Shmona Esrei with this next pasuk, Kishem Hashem Ekra V'Goldo L'Kenu. So everyone knows the pasuk from there. But the pasuk is very significant in terms of halacha because it's quoted in the Gemara in a lot of different contexts and is possibly the source for a number of different halachas. So one possibility, the Gemara Masechet Brachos and Daf Chaf Aleph understands that this is possibly the source for Birchas HaTorah Min HaTorah. We know that Brachos in general are Drabanan. The one definite exception is Berchas HaMazon, that's the Beferish Pasuk in Parashas Ekev, Yechalta V'Savato V'Rachta. And the second likely exception is Berchas HaTorah. Berchas HaTorah is two different Makoros and Shas, which suggest that it's Daraisa. One of the Gemara seems to learn it as a Kal V'Chomer from benching in one place. And in addition to that, the Gemara on Daf Chaf Aleph ties it to this Pasuk, Kishem HaShem Ekra HaVagolda L'Elokeinu. So how does that tie in? So the Maharsha comments that this is based on the Ramban. That the Ramban, not the Gemara is based on the Ramban, but it can be understood based on the Ramban, that the Ramban in his Hakdama to the Chumash, Hakdama to his Perish on Chumash, so he explains that from a mystical perspective, that the entire Torah is a Tzirufei Shemos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's God's name in different formulations, rearranged as sentences and mitzvot that we can read in that form. So therefore the whole Torah is Shem Hashem. So the pasuk is saying when we call out Shem Hashem, when we declare Shem Hashem, so we should first have a goda l'keinu, we should say a bracha, we should praise God. This could be relevant. The Shagas Aryeh has a whole discussion. There's a lot to say about Brachas HaTorah. We have to figure out how much we'll say about it today without taking up all our time for other topics, but just to throw out a few of the important ideas about Brachas HaTorah. There's a whole discussion, the Shulchan Aruch paskins, that one does not make Brachas HaTorah unless one is speaking out loud. If one is just being Maharher B'Divrei Torah, so he doesn't make a bracha, and the Vilna Gaon disagreed. And there's a lot to be said about what that machlokus is about. Again, it's worthy of a much longer discussion. And what makes it a little bit of a more powerful question is that the Shulchan Aruch also paskins that if you're writing Divrei Torah, so you do make a bracha. And it's a question of why is writing not called hearer? So that's a whole discussion what exactly the story is by Brachas HaTorah and hearer. So the Shagas Aryeh suggests that there's a raya from this drasha that it's about spoken Torah. Kishem Hashem Ekra. I'm going to say something out loud. So the Baruch Tam had a whole hasaga on this, that he thinks the pasuk is not talking about the Ekra, is not talking about the Talmud Torah, it's talking about the bracha. So how do we know that you have to say the Torah out loud? Maybe you have to say the bracha out loud. So as the Paris Yosef Acharish points out, that if you say like the Marsha, that's what he's explaining what the Gemara means, that the Ekra is the Talmud Torah, that Kriya Shem Hashem is the learning, and therefore when you do that, you should be have a Godel Elokeinu. You should express your gratitude to, you should express your gratitude to God. There is a major debate that, again, I have to figure out how much we could say about it time-wise, but so it sounds like from all of this that Berachas HaTorah is Daraisa, and that was the view that the Ramban expressed. The problem is he expresses it in his Hasagas on the Rambam, because the Rambam does not count it as a mitzvah, giving you the impression that the Rambam understands it to be a Din Darabanan, which is something you have to reconcile with all these Gemaras. So the Ramban has it in his Hosafas, Mitzvah Saseh Tesvav. But the Rambam, you have to figure out, the Achronim have a lot to say about this, as you can imagine. Rav Zsolti, for one, has a big piece about this, where he suggests, from a perspective of Lamdus, that the Ramban sees it as a bracha of Huda, similar to Berachas HaMazon. We're grateful for our food, so we're grateful for our Torah. So we'll make a bracha like that, so it's comparable to the Din Daraisa of Berachas HaMazon. And the Rambam saw it as a Berachas HaMitzvah. So Berachas HaMitzvah in general are Drabanan. So the Berachas HaMitzvah of Berachas HaTorah is also Drabanan. You still have to figure out what he does with the Makaris and Shas. But that's a whole discussion again for a longer time, a little bit. But the Shagas Aryeh, so he said he thinks it's got to be Daraisa, because the Gemara Masachis Nedarim on Daf Pei Aleph has a famous line that Yerushalayim was destroyed on Ma'av the Aretz. Why did the Golos take place? Why did the Chorban take place? Azvan is Tarasi. So the Gemara says Al Shalom Berchu Al Torah Tchila. They didn't recite Berchus Al Torah, so that's why they went through such a Chorban. So the Shagas Aryeh says if it was such an onish, it must be its Daraisa. It can't be that there was such an onish for the Rabbanan. Now, it doesn't really answer the question, because even if it's Daraisa, it would still need more of an explanation. But he brought that as a Rav Moshe Feinstein in the beginning of his Tshuvas in Negros Moshe. He has a Tshuva about that. So we'll come back to that point again in a second. The Mishkanes Yaakov has a Tshuva, Tzor HaChaim Siman Samach Gimel, where he assumes that it's Daraisa only in public. That so, for example, a person gets an aliyah, so it's daraisa, which could explain why, what the nature of a bracha on aliyah is. That maybe the bracha on aliyah is a bracha satorah, and even though you made a bracha in the morning, but the bracha in the morning that was only a drabanan, and now you're getting an aliyah, you have to make a bracha to the Mishkanes Yaakov.
Would that mean, it's not really relevant, because not really shliach tzibur then, but I guess if someone verbalizes it as the chazan during Berachos HaShachar, and then he gets an aliyah afterwards according to that, he would have to make a second one?
I think still it was
the Rabbanan the first time.
Also, he was doing it on the level of the Rabbanan, now he's chayav deraisa because of the public Talmud Torah. So just, again, trying to triage what to say about Berachos HaTorah in our time frame. But since we can also be Mekayim talking about Sukkot with the following point, so we should definitely mention Rav Soloveitchik's famous drasha. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but they published many years ago a kuntras that was called, I forgot what it's called, but it's the kuntras published by Hamavasser. It was lectures of Rav Soloveitchik. And there was one lecture there that was called Impromptu Remarks at a Siyum. I think they were learning, they finished a parak in Chulin, I believe, and the Rav was asked to say something. So he said the following very famous word, became very famous. And it's relevant to Sukkot as well, so it's a little timely. That Tosfos and Maseches Brachos and Daf Yud Aleph, Tosfos asks, why is it that we treat Berachas HaTorah differently than Sukkah? That we know that on Sukkah, so if a person has breakfast in the Sukkah, so he'll make a bracha leishit b'sukkah, and then maybe he'll go to work or he'll do whatever he does, he'll leave the Sukkah, and he'll come back for lunch. So he comes back for lunch, he makes another bracha on the Sukkah. And then he'll go about his day, he'll come back for dinner, he'll make a bracha on the Sukkah again. So we seem to assume that the bracha gets interrupted. He has to come back and make a new bracha when he comes back for the next session. So why don't we say the same for Talmud Torah? So somebody is learning all day without stopping, so that's terrific. But it's often the case that that's not what's happening, so maybe somebody can learn a few minutes after Shacharis, and then he goes and he does something else. And then he has time during his lunch break to learn a little more. And then after that he goes and he does something else. And then maybe he goes to a shir at night, he has a chavrusha at night. So all those different sessions, why don't we treat that like a sukkah, where each time he goes in and makes a new bracha. Why is it that we're satisfied with one bracha in the morning and that's it? It's a stamma question which we won't get into for the interest of time as to what the machayev is. Is it the morning or is it a new day or is it sleeping? That's a whole discussion, impacts on shavuos and the like about what you do. That you could talk about it for many hours, but let's assume so we make it once a day. But why shouldn't we make it many times a day? Why shouldn't we say every time a person learns after having interrupted for some significant period of time? So we should obligate him in the new bracha like we do with sukkah. So Tosfos says something along the lines of Torah is different because we're never Mesiach Dasrimah. So that's very nice, if it's true, that's very inspiring. Is that really the case, that during the course of our day we're still holding in the sugi all day? So Rav Soloveitchik in this famous drasha, so he explained Tosfos to mean that the relationship of the Jew to Torah is like the mother who has a young baby, has a child. So perhaps a lot of the time she's actively taking care of the child. But there's also possibly some time when she's not actively taking care of the child. Maybe the child is at home and she's out shopping and she's doing something else. She's not with the child right now. But the child is never out of her mind completely. The existence of the child is always connected to her consciousness. It may not be what she's actively engaged in right now, but there's always a latent awareness of the child. And the Rav said that was what Tosfos was saying, that we're always connected to Torah on that level. And even if we're not holding in the sukkah right now and we're doing other things, but the Torah is always kind of now with the nowadays you have computers with different windows open, so you can relate to things. That Chavetz Chaim commented that one of the advantages of the technology is that sometimes we can understand concepts that we couldn't picture beforehand, but now we can. So you have a window open in the background, it's always open. So to speak, the relation to learning is always there. So you're not chayiv in a new bracha. Unless you are, what are you? So if you sleep, maybe that's the whole discussion, or if it's a new day, so then without getting into the whole Shua Sugya, that's a whole discussion when you eventually do become Chayav. But along these lines, so some of the Rishonim actually suggested that that's Pshat in the Gemara and Adarim that we said we don't really understand, even with the Shagasariya. So Shagasariya said that it's got to be Daraisa, because how could we have such an Onesh? So doesn't still explain why it should be that that's even if it's Daraisa, so that still doesn't explain why we get the gullus for this one mitzvah, one bittel mitzvah zaseh, even Daraisa. So some explain that that's like Tosfos is saying, that really we are not chayiv in Brachas HaTorah during the daytime after our first one, because we maintain a total God consciousness, we maintain some kind of a connection to learning throughout the day. But the Jews of that era, so they had activities during the day in which they were completely disconnected, in which they completely forgot to have any kind of a connection. And therefore, they became chayiv in a new Berachas HaTorah, unlike what Tosfos describes about the Klal Yisrael today, that we feel that we're always still in the sugya, so to speak. So at that time, they allowed the connection to completely fail, and there would have been chayiv in a new Berachas HaTorah. And that's the issue. Just while I'm mentioning that, so others understand that the importance of Berachas HaTorah in that context is that it creates a religious experience, and it creates an experience where it's going to have an impact on us. And if we don't appreciate what the Torah is, both from a religious perspective and just as something for which we have to have gratitude, so then it's not going to have an impact on us. It's not going to be able to do anything for us. The Maharal explains the Gemara in that light, that the Gemara's question was not what avera did they do that made them deserve the churban? Because we know the Gemara tells us what averas they did. They did a lot of terrible averas. We know that. So the Maharal says the Gemara's question is something else. The Gemara's question is, okay, so they did all these averas and they were chayiv churban. But we also know that they were involved in learning. It's not the case that there was no learning going on. So the question the Gemara wants to know is, how could it happen? How could it happen that people are so involved in learning and yet it's not going to change them enough that they're not going to be guilty of such terrible averas? And to that, the Gemara answers, lo berchu la Torah tchila. They didn't recite berchas haTorah. They didn't see the Torah as a religious experience, as something that should have an impact on them. And therefore, it didn't. And therefore, the result was that they were chayev terrible onshin. Just while we're mentioning that point, so to skip around a little bit, so that that could also, it's also connected to the end of this aliyah. So the pasuk says, am noval v'lo chacham, that the nation that is not wise, and noval, a whole discussion of what that word means in this context. We'll go into different ways to interpret it, but you see the Onkla says, Amad de Kabilu Araisa V'lo Chakimu. Sounds like a contradiction, right? They received the Torah, but they were not Chachamim. And the point being that apparently it's possible to be involved in learning and not to allow it to have an impact on you. And that's what we're being criticized for here. And that's what that pasuk is saying, Am Naval V'lo Chacham. There is such a thing that people can be connected to, can be involved in learning and still not have it have an impact on them.
So it's related to Naval
V'Shur Sitar. So it's not the same word, but I mean, it's probably not the same word, but it could come to the same theme, right? It's okay, at least homiletically, it's right. No, it could be the same. I mean, the truth is, we're not sure what it means in this context exactly. So it could be. At least homiletically, it connects for sure. So that's it. Berchas haTorah is only one of many dinim that's possibly derived from this famous pasuk. Another one is the din of Zimun. That's what the Gemara Maseches Brachos on Daf Mem Hei and Aleph has. It's two separate dinim deraisa involved with benching, that the act of benching itself, as even as an individual, is a act of deraisa. And then if there are three people together, so then there's a chiyuv Zimun. And that's derived from the pasuk. It's talking in plural. So you're saying that hevu godol lekeinu. So that's plural language. You're talking to plural, and one person is at least one person is saying this to at least two other people. So that gives us three for a zimun. So when you have three together, so there is a chiyuv zimun. Which just to say one word about that, so Rav Shechter quotes often in his farm from Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Baruch Pavarsky has a whole essay along these lines as well in his sefer Bad Kodesh. That Zimun is really a different construct than we fully appreciate today, that it's the creation of a Berchas HaMazon of the Chabura. And that's why, really, strictly speaking, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, the way it was meant to be done is not the way we do it today. Today you have a Zimun, so everyone benches on their own. And the Mezamein holds back a little bit for the four brachos parts, and then when everyone's quiet, he says the four brachos elam. But historically, it wasn't necessarily meant to be done that way, that really one person should bench on behalf of the tzibur, on behalf of the Mezamein, and everyone listens, and as Yotzei, that way. And it could be that that's what Chazar Sashat says also. It's not midin shemeya ka'oneh. It's a whole different kind of construct. It's that we create a chabura, we create a unit, and there's one benching happening on behalf of the unit. So that's a question why we don't do it like that today, or why most people don't do it like that. I won't say nobody does it like that today, but it's not commonly done like that today. So some of the commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch, it sounds like we're afraid that people can't pay such close attention anymore. We're not in the Madrega to focus so well that we could listen to one person's benching without benching ourselves. And be yotzei that way, so we evolved this different format where we all do bench, and just for the key brachos parts, we listen to the mezamein after we've said it ourselves. But strictly speaking, this idea of a zimun daraisa seems to be a slightly different model. And there's a third din the Gemara has, that the Gemara Maseches Yuma and Daf Lamed Zayin. The Gemara learns that when it means that Moshe was saying that when I call out Hashem's name, so you, Bnei Yisrael, you should have a golden volcano. You should say something. So the Gemara says that when the Kohen in the Mikdash, Beis HaMikdash, would praise God, so the Jews would respond, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus L'Leon Vayi, that we have such a structure of a response. So the Torah Tmimut has a whole discussion. He says he doesn't understand why it is that people have the practice, even though Shulchan Aruch says to do it this way, but he thinks it's wrong based on this. He says that when a person gets an aliyah, so he says, Baruch Hashem Barach, and everyone says Baruch Hashem Barach Leolam Vayed, and then he repeats that line and then says the bracha. So the Torah Tumi says he doesn't understand why he should repeat the line, that this is the Tzibor's line. He doesn't have to repeat it. He says he doesn't understand based on these Gemaras why he repeats it himself. And this is the Marmi Rutenberg with the Beis Yosef quotes, even though Shulchan Aruch says differently, but the Marmi Rutenberg says like him that this is not for the Ola to repeat. Okay. So at least those three dinim possibly connected to that pasuk. So I'll just mention a little bit more about this parsha, so we could still say something about Yom Kippur. So first of all, this important line here also, Atzor Tamim Palo, that God is a rock, which is good and bad for us. I mean, it's all ultimately good, but it means that God is consistent. So the Gemara understands from here that one shouldn't say that a Kadosh Baruch Hu vastron her, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Meichel too easily. Obviously God is Meichel, we believe, you know, that's what Tshuva is about. But the Vasron has the connotation, even though it's a little bit difficult to understand the difference, but Vasron has a connotation like, God doesn't care. You know, we could do whatever we want because he's not really Makbid, so to speak. So it's not that he's not Makbid, he's Makbid, but he also gives us the potential of Tshuva, and he's also a Rachaman. He can eventually pardon us. But it's not because he doesn't care in the first place. So this idea of Hatsur is that there's a certain reality to a rock. A rock doesn't bend. And so too, God's laws are in the same category, though. The rule is there. We can't tell ourselves that, oh, he's not Makbid. He is Makbid. Hopefully he'll be Mochel us. Hopefully he'll have Rachmanis on us. But a person that does whatever he wants with the attitude of Kadosh Baruch Hu Vastron Hu, so that's a very dangerous attitude, the Gemara says, to say the least. And it refers to a Kadosh Baruch Hu in that context as a tzaddik v'yashar. So that those two terms are important. You know, what exactly is the difference? And what's better? Is it better to be a tzaddik? Is it better to be a yashar? It's a whole discussion. It sounds like from the Gemara in Tainus, like yashrus is better. That's where Rashi interprets the Gemara in Tainus. Because the Gemara over there says, Daf Tezvav and Aleph, the Gemara there says that lo hakol la'ora, lo hakol le'simcha, tzaddikim le'ora, yisharim le'simcha. Shenamar or zaruah la'tzaddik le'yishri le'ev simcha. So that's the breakdown. That the tzaddikim, they get ora, and the yisharim, they get simcha. So it's not clear what the difference between the two terms are, but Rashi over there comments that yisharim are better. So you have two chidushim that it's better to be a yashar than to be a tzaddik, and that simcha apparently is a higher madriga than ora. So you have to figure out what all of that means and what the two terminologies means. And it's Siv, in his writings, he always emphasizes, he quotes here, but very well known, his Hakdamah to Sefer Bereishis, where he talks about the concept of Yashrus. And he understands Yashrus to be a part of the functioning Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. It refers to one's relationship to others. And all the time, the Torah uses that word, Tov HaYashar, Yashar V'Hatov, all of those connotations. So he explains that's what it means. And here too we have this usage of tzaddik v'yashar, Kadosh Baruch Hu is both k'v'yachal, whatever that means practically. So we won't do too much about the second aliyah, but in honor of our practice of talking about the second aliyah, we'll just make a reference to the first pasuk. So the first pasuk has the opening line, Zechor Yemo Salam. So many point to this pasuk as a mucker for an obligation to learn Jewish history. That you have to be aware of the history of the Jewish people, and you should ask the elders to tell you what has been. And it's especially evocative in terms of Parshas Hazinu. We know whenever you learn history in general, so you get the famous quote from George Santayana that those who don't learn history are doomed to repeat it. So that in the context of Hazinu, it makes a lot of sense. If you say this is a mucker to learn history, Jewish history, the history of the Jewish people, so here the context of Tochefa, so we have to learn what went wrong in the past so we don't do it again. So it happens to fit well with such a connotation that that's what the parasha is telling us. But the Gemara in the second parak of Shabbos also uses it in a different context and kind of suggests that it is a mucker for the concept of dinim derabanan. That the Gemara talks about the bracha that we say on the Hanukkah candles. We say Asher Kishana Mitzvosa V'Tzivanu L'Hadlik Ner Shel Hanukkah. So the Gemara asks, Heichan Tzivanu? We just said God commanded us to light Hanukkah candles. When did He do that? When did He command us? So one answer that is given in the Gemara there is Shalavicha V'Yageidcha. The other answer is the famous pasuk in Parsha Shoftim of Lo Sasser. So the Torah Tumimah has a comment where he says that it's hard to know from those Gemaras whether it's a proof for the Rambam or the Ramban, because the Rambam seems to say that Dinim Derabanan, for the most part at least, are derived from the pasuk of Lo Sasser, and the Ramban argues, and therefore the Ramban would read those Gemaras as an Asmachta. So the Torah Tumimah says he thinks this Gemara that quotes Shalavicha V'Yageidcha is a proof that there are Asmachtas, because Shalavicha V'Yageidcha is hard to read that as literally addressing a Koach of Chazal. So presumably that's an Asmachta. So from the same breath, the Gemara also offers Lo Sasser as a source. It's probably also an Asmachta, and that's how he assumed. And that's a part of that whole Machlokas. Okay, so in the few minutes that we have left, yes, sir.
Sorry, in terms of what was mentioned about Jewish history, since something that obviously doesn't have, I guess, Dvar Shavik Dusha in it, but you'd be doing it L'Shem Shemayim, does that mean it would be inappropriate as bathroom reading?
Not necessarily, because there are other mitzvahs that one can do in the bathroom. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's... Yeah, it's the difference between Dvar Shavik Dusha and the mitzvah. So Kedusha is one thing, but something that happens to fulfill a religious value. If you read a science textbook also, so it's what the Rambam writes in Mitzvah Avos Hashem. A person understands the world of all kinds of things that one could do that will have a mitzvah value. It's not necessarily going to...
Excuse to not study.
Right. It's not going to help you either. But okay, so that's that. So let's just try to say a few words to fill in some of the points about, let's say very briefly about, I guess, three subjects that we started or that we gave at some Aramakomos about. So let's just try to say a few words about each to mekayim what we wanted to do. So first of all, we spoke last week about the obligation of Mechila, but we left out one major element of it. That what we essentially talked about is we saw three angles in why we would ask for Mechila. We talked about the fact that there is a need to get the charges dropped. The person, so to speak, could be prosecuting us, so we have to get him to waive the charges. But we saw that that didn't answer everything, because if the person is mochel right away, without your asking, most poskim assume, and they're raised from the Gemara this way, that you still have to ask. So we then discussed two other possibilities. One, that it's a process of busha, the process of submission, which is valuable. And we noted that could explain the Shulchan Aruch, that if you ask three times and you don't get a yes, so you're off the hook because you've gone through the process. And then we went on to a different interpretation, that it's about reconciliation, that it's about addressing the hurt that has happened, and that's a separate value. I happened to be talking yesterday with my good friend Rabbi David Gottlieb, maybe familiar with his many shirim on Wayu Torah. So he was suggesting that if you say this pshat, that it's about reconciliation, so how do we understand the din in the Shulchan Aruch that if you ask three times, you're off the hook, you haven't reconciled, so you haven't fulfilled this. According to the previous draft, it's about the process of submission. Okay, so you've done that, but if it's about reconciliation, how do we understand it? So he wanted to suggest, avort, that the din is, you have to fix the mess that you made, so to speak. You have to fix the tension that you created. So maybe the chiddush is that if three times you're not getting a response, that's already considered unreasonable. So it's now his tension. He's the one who created tension. So you're no longer mechuyev to ask for mechila to address the tension that he's creating. It's now shifted over to him. Could be, but it's a good segue into our last phase of the discussion, because once we say that it's about addressing tension, so then that's where we also have an idea that there's a chiyev not only on the avarian, let's say. In general, most machlokes in between people, both parties think that they're the other one's the aggressor and they're the victim. But let's even pretend for a second that we can all agree on who an aggressor is and who a victim is, which will rarely be the case, but let's assume that that's the case. So for sure there's a chiyuv on the aggressor to ask for mechila. But the victim also has a responsibility. So ideally, or beyond that, if the victim can take the first step, so then that's also a mila. But let's say he can't take the first step, but if the person has asked him, so then really he has an obligation to respond affirmatively. The person has asked appropriately, based on what we've discussed so far, that he's gone through enough of a process and he's asked sincerely and genuinely, and it's not something that has damage that is going unfixed. So then it's not right not to be mocho. And the Mishnah in Bava Kama says that Daf Tzadi Beis, that a person should not be an achzar and not forgive. And the Yerushalmi version of that Mishnah, it seems to take it a little further, seems to say it's an avera, not to forgive. And that's a discussion the poskim have. There's a discussion some shuvas talk about this, we know comes up. Let's say somebody takes a shvua that he's not going to be mochel somebody. So is that shvua chal? We should say it's a shvua against the Torah. So that's a discussion. For technical reasons, some of the poskim thought the shvua was chal, but at least in theory, you could argue that it's a illegitimate shvua because it's against the Torah. Hi.
But if we're going to say that's really Torah reconciliation, we're saying that your actual din, whether you're going to get some Gehenna or not, when God's decision is done, is based on some other guy?
It's a good question. It's interesting because the Meiri there actually comments, and you could question it. Meiri says, why does the Mishnah use the word achzar? He says, you're cruel because you don't care what happens to this guy. This guy's going to get punished on your behalf, so to speak. So that's what Meiri sounds like, but you could argue on that, because you could say that essentially if the person has gone through everything he has to do, and you're refusing, so then you don't have the ability to hold back his kapara. There is an interesting discussion. The Sefer Shari Zvulun just came out with a volume on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, where he talks about focusing especially on this whole issue of reconciliation, that the ikuv that the Mishnah talks about, the idea that you're not going to have a successful Yom Kippur without mechila. So what's lacking? Is it the tshuva that's lacking? Your maisa tshuva is incomplete if you don't ask for mechila? Or is it the kapara, that you can't get a kapara that without having gone through this? And is it a Yom Kippur din, or is it something separate? He has a whole discussion about that. So this Miri is a little difficult in that light. But there's also, along the lines of that question about the shvua, so the Rush has a tshuva, that this is also something that we know happens in the world. What if a parent says to a child, I forbid you from forgiving so-and-so? So should we say that there's a kibud aveim there, or should we say that the parent is instructing the kid to do an aveira, which is the way the Rush assumes? It's against the Torah. We know that kibud aveim doesn't apply to tell a child to do an aveira. Maybe this is included, that saying you shouldn't be mochel is considered to be an avera. There is an interesting discussion, if you have a moment to look at it. There's a nice contemporary sefer in Ben Adam L'Chavero. It's called L'Reyacha Kamocha. It's written by Rav David Aryab. So he has a whole discussion about whether the model of mechila, and it correlates to what we've been talking about, is it basically like monetary mechila, a person is mochel a chov, or is it more an emotional reality that's not really comparable to monetary mechila? And you can take a look for the, I think I may have put on the Mar Makomos that he wants to be medayik and Rashi and the Meiri on the Mishnah Bava Kama, in terms of his idea of whether somebody, you should ask mechila because a person is doeg right now, or because da'ag, a person went through something in the past. So you could quibble with that maybe, but the whole discussion is probably parallel to this question. Is it about dropping charges, or is it about actually reconciling? And there are many nafkaminas, as he points out. Let's say, can you reverse mechila? If a person gave mechila but then decided later that he has reasons to still be makbid, maybe he made a mistake, maybe he didn't, whatever it is, but things changed. So can he unmochel somebody? So there's a famous vort they say from Yisrael Salanta, that he gave advice, he gave an etzah, that if somebody gets offended by somebody else, he should immediately be mochel. Because then, real halachic man, he won't be able to be makbid later. Because Same way if somebody owes you money and you say I'm mochel. So you can't decide a week later actually I need the money, so you have to give it to me. If you're mochel the chov, it doesn't exist anymore. So if a person will be mochel the offense, it won't exist anymore. So that's assuming a very monetary model of what's going on, which is itself up to discussion. There was also a famous story they say about the stipler, that the stipler showed up at somebody's bar mitzvah. You heard the story? Stipler showed up at somebody's bar mitzvah in Bnei Brak. Couldn't figure out what he was doing there, and he said that 6 years ago, this boy was 7 years old, the stipler offended him. They were davening on Yom Kippur, and it looked like the boy was learning during davening, so the stipler said to him, this isn't a time for learning, it's a time for davening. And then he saw that he actually had a big machzor that looked like a gemara, so he felt bad that he offended this boy for no reason. He wanted to ask him for mechila. So the cut is not ben mechila, so he has to wait until it's clear. By the way, halchos and os devarim, there's an isser and os devarim by a cut, which is a big thing because you know, it's hard to always be makrid on that, and it's a big thing, especially if you're going to say that they can't be mochels, then you really it's a bigger deal than by an adult. So they have to figure out what you mean by mochel. I mean, so monetary right, they don't have the right to be mochel, but they have the ability to reconcile, hopefully, the ability to get over things. So that's, again, the question of what kind of model of mechila are we talking about. So speaking about ketanim, so just to very quickly address the two other topics that we had on the Marmakom sheet, just that we should have some keyim of talking about them also once we spend time looking at them. So one topic that you saw about was the question of Inuyim on Yom Kippur. So the Inuyim, certainly the concept of fasting on Yom Kippur is a Daraisa, a Chiyuv Karis. But what about the other Inuyim, the other four Inuyim? So are those Daraisa? So that, you see, the Gemara has different drushes, it has a couple of different drushes, opening up the possibility a little more so that maybe they are Asmachtas. And the Rishonim have a big debate to basically split down the middle whether they are Daraisa or Darabanan. And to continue the split, the Ran has a cryptic comment, if you got a chance to see the Ran. And it's not clear how he holds, because he starts off saying it's Daraisa, he asks the Kasha on that, and then it's not clear what his conclusion is. So he continues the split, and if you read the Achronim, we talk about the Ran, they're about split, it's about 50-50. About half of them will say the Ran says it's Daraisa, but half of them will say the Ran says the Drabanan. So the Kasha that he talks about is, if these acts are Daraisa, how come we allow ketanim to engage in them and we facilitate it? We provide them for ketanim. Why don't we say that it's like feeding a katan non-kosher food? The Gemara says that it's usher to feed a katan non-kosher food. Usher l'safos b'yadayim, different drushes the Gemara has for that din. So why don't we say the same should apply here as well? So you have to figure out certain points of that question. I mean, is he assuming that if it's drabanan or b'mutter? Some of the Rishonim assume that even by nesed drabanan we have such a din. And also, what about eating and drinking, which is for sure Daraisa? So is he assuming that that's only mutter because it's pikuach nefesh? It's difficult to say. There are svarim that say like that, but in practice, we don't assume that we treat ketanim, and would not advise treating ketanim as if they're only eating because pikuach nefesh. Maybe as a matter of policy, we just think it's dangerous, and then we don't actually put it into practice at all. But there's a sefer called Milui Shlomo, written by Shlomo Lorenz. He has a long essay to prove that the heter for ketanim to eat on Yom Kippur, for parents to feed their children on Yom Kippur, is not based on pikuach nefesh. So that's for sure deraisa. So you have to figure out how you deal with that. But there are various approaches to answer this question of the Rans, that why should we allow these inuyim to be provided for a katan if they're essentially like non-kosher food on a level of minat Torah. So one approach Achronim have, and Magen Avraham talks about this, is that something that's only usher temporarily, we can't call that inherently usher. And maybe the whole issue for ketanim is like, you don't want to give them pork. Which you could say two ways. One is you could say we're afraid they'll become used to eating pork, and that's a problem. And if it's food on Yom Kippur, so we're not worried they're going to eat when they grow up. They're not going to associate eating davka with the 10th of Tishrei. It's not going to be connected in that sense. Or you could say it more lumdish-wise, that pork is iser cheftza because it's usur all the time, and therefore it's more spiritually damaging even for a katan who's not chayiv mitzvahs. But something that's usur temporarily, so many achronim assume that that's not inherently usur, because how could it be that 354 days a year food is mutter, all of a sudden in Yom Kippur all the food is usur b'cheftza? Can't be. 51 weeks a year, chametz is mutter on Pesach. All of a sudden, it changes to Isur Chafzo. So many achronim thought that that's the case. Yosef Engel has an essay in Ask for the Raisa where he argues on that whole principle. He thinks, yeah, it could be an Isser Chavtz even temporarily. But that's one approach that some have, that if something is only an Isser, if something is only temporarily Usser, so then that's not going to apply. The Magen Avraham talks about this in Hilchos Shabbos because the question comes up, a Kiddush Friday night in Shul. So we assume the one making Kiddush can't drink the wine because he's not Yotze with that Kiddush, and therefore he's still Usser to eat or drink anything. So the practice is to give the wine to Ketanim in Shul. So the question is, but if it's Usser for the grown-ups, why is it Mutter for the Ketanim? Why is it not in the same category? So many assume the similar logic that the wine is not inherently Usser, it's just that moment. It's not Mutter yet, also Isser Aseh, as they point out. So that's enough reason to be Mekel. Others suggest, in terms of the tainus, that there's no isser if the experience is different for an adult than for a child. So you talk about eating pork, it's essentially the same thing for a katan and for an adult. But the experience of fasting is fundamentally different for a mature person than for a child. So we wouldn't impose the experience of fasting on somebody who's biologically not yet capable to go through it. And others say similarly, but a little different, that if you can't have the whole concept of a fast, it doesn't make sense to have it only partially, and say, well, we'll have it a little bit and only allow it when it's mamshi b'guach nefesh. So there's no point in that. Either they're going to be able to fast or they're not going to be able to fast, and to say, well, they have to fast until they klotz because we have to train them in that, doesn't make sense. Some assume like that as well. So we'll just say few more words about what you looked at today, about the mitzvah of eating tomorrow, possibly tonight, machlokas, but the mitzvah of eating on Erev Yom Kippur. So we see that the Gemara tells us a drasha and a pasuk that you have to eat on Erev Yom Kippur. It sounds like it's a real drasha. This is a discussion, if you saw the Kesef question, Helfos Nadarim, is it an asmach, is it a real drasha? So the irony is, the Gemara also uses it for another din of Tosefes Yom Kippur. And as the Ksav Sofer and the Machzav Ram had a whole machlokas, that the two dinim could theoretically be in opposition to each other, because you could be that you haven't got a chance to eat until right before Yom Kippur, and now you have two dinim learned out from the same pasuk in conflict with each other. You have to figure out what takes priority. That's the whole literature. But in terms of why you have the mitzvah, so there are many, many, many suggestions in the later literature. And the Rishonim, they're basically two. And the Rabbeinu Yonah goes through them all, the Ritva and the Rosh Hashanah that you saw, the Rosh and Yuma talks about. So in Rishonim, there are basically two or three. And the later literature, they came up with a lot of creative suggestions that go beyond those two. But it's either considered to be a preparation for the Tainus, which probably means to help the Tainus. There is a view based on the Tarat Mima has that maybe it's meant to intensify the Tainus because he goes from straight indulge a feast to famine, so to speak. And the other approach is that it's a simchas yontif, that we should really have a suda, but we can't have the suda on the day. As we said, it's a big technical problem, so we'll have it on the day before.
Does that imply that it is the Tosefes?
Not exactly, because if it actually wasn't kept, the Tosefes is a diminutive for sure, right? So we can't have both the suda and Tosefes at the same time. Right, maybe it's for part of it, for the, just for simchas yontif without the, you know, or the yisrim. So, could be. But one point that's very kedai to know about is a famous comment of Rabbi Akiva Eger that a lot of other achronim discussed as well. That Rabbi Akiva Eger was asked, there was a woman who was sick, she was a chola, and therefore she wasn't planning on fasting on Yom Kippur. And the question was, is she obligated to eat on Erev Yom Kippur? It's hard to understand the nature of this machlokes that she has to eat on Yom Kippur, has to not eat the day before, but whatever, somehow that was the question. Should she be obligated to eat on Erev Yom Kippur if she's not going to fast on Yom Kippur? So Rabbi Akiva Eger and many others, the Ksav Sofer, understood the question as follows. Now let's look at it. So there's two separate questions here. She's a woman and she's a chola. So is a woman obligated to eat an Erev Yom Kippur? Maybe you should say it's a mitzvah saying Shas Magram. So he says, well, it's totally. It's basically the simchas yontif for Yom Kippur, so it's a mitzvah saying Shas Magram. If it's a preparation for the fast, then it makes sense to say that whoever is obligated in the fast is probably obligated in this act of preparation for the fast, and therefore women are obligated. Now, what about a chola? Is a chola who's not fasting obligated? Says, yeah, it's probably also told that if it's simchas yontif, so then why should the chola not participate? But if it's about preparation for the fast, then maybe you could say somebody who's not fasting is not obligated. Let's say Chemed didn't like that so far, but he says, who knows what will happen tomorrow? We'll have a miraculous refuah tomorrow. Why shouldn't you be remiss for today? But on the surface, that's how you assume that if you're not fasting, you're not chayiv in this preparation. after the fact. So therefore, in this case of this woman, he said that mimamsha, she's off halacha, because if it's out of preparation for the fast, she's off halacha because she's not fasting. And if it's out of sefer, so then she's off the hook because it's a mitzvah saseh shahazman gram. That's a possibility. In any event, in practice, we try to be machmir certainly for men, for women also, else out that probably are chayavos. The Torah Tamim has arrived. We got a chance to see the Gemara in Beitza. So the Gemara seems to have a somewhat of an offensive statement. The Gemara says that the mutav shushogin v'alyum azidim, we don't tell somebody not to do something that they're not going to listen to anyway. And the Gemara gives this example. You can't figure out where it's coming from. The Gemara says, you like the women that they eat on Erev Yom Kippur and they don't realize the din of Tosefes Yom Kippur, they should stop eating earlier. So we don't tell them because they're not going to listen. So Torah Tamim says, well, where'd you get that attitude from? That you assume that the women aren't going to listen because you tell them that there is such a din, why should they not listen? So he thought maybe you could say that's a raya that they're chayav in the mitzvah of the Achilas Erev Yom Kippur, because there's so few mitzvah saseh shazman gramba that they're chayavos in, they'll have such a chavivus for this mitzvah, so then it's going to be very hard to separate from it. So it's not that they're not going to listen in general, it's that this mitzvah is such a rare opportunity to have a mitzvah saseh shazman gramba, so that's a raya that they are chayav in. So l'chachila will assume that men and women are all chayav in this, and it should be the fulfillment of the words of Chazal, Ki'ilu Hosana Tisha V'Asiri, it should have a positive effect on our fast experience, and we should have a Gemar Chasim Tova. It should be conducive to our tshuva and to our growth, and it should be a wonderful Yantif and a wonderful Sukkot. And I look forward to seeing you after Sukkot.